Girl, let's not be friends, 'cause we've shared too much. Girl, you know that I'm yearning for your touch, 'cause I can't be less.
That's just the kind of singing you'd expect to hear on American Idol, which is why you hear it in the new movie American Dreams. It's a satire about an American Idol-type program and what happens when an inept terrorist ends up being one of the contestants and a dim-witted American president becomes the guest judge on the final edition, hoping to give his own popularity a boost. The movie was written and directed by my guest Paul Weitz. He also wrote and directed the comedy In Good Company, and with his brother Chris Weitz, he made the movies American Pie and About a Boy. Here's a scene from early in American Dreams. The president, played by Dennis Quaid, has just been reelected. He's in the bedroom with the first lady, doing something very out of character, reading the newspaper, when his chief of staff walks into the room. The first lady is played by Marcia Gay Harden. The chief of staff is played by Willem Dafoe, who's made up to look like Dick Cheney.
What's with the papers?
New puppy?
They're newspapers.
I can see that. Hi, Mrs. P. You look beautiful.
Wally.
So, Mr. P, you ready to meet the press?
Not right now.
Mr. P, we discussed this. I mean, it was your idea to meet the press after the big win. Heralding a new era of openness, what with our overwhelming mandate?
Yeah, I know. It's just that there is a lot of stuff in here. There's a lot of interesting things.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of stuff. They have to fill the pages with something. But I think interesting is stretching it.
Well, for instance, did you know that there are two kinds of Rakistanis? Actually, three kinds of Iraqis.
Do you mean Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds?
You knew about this?
Paul Weitz, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you get the idea for bringing together American Idol, the American president, and suicide bombers?
Well, it seemed like a natural, doesn't it? In fact, I had to race it to theaters to beat the competing studio's show tune singing terrorist projects to the screen. Really, it was from observing the strange process of my day, which was I'd wake up, read the papers, and become stressed out about terrorism and whether the administration was handling things in the proper way. And then by the evening, I was just watching TV and worrying about whether Constantine was going to get kicked off American Idol, as if there's absolutely nothing going on in the world that affected me. And this odd sort of Mel Brooks, Woody Allen-esque figure of the bumbling show tune singing terrorist came to me, and I worked out this whole story, and I would pitch it to friends, and I felt like it was a really insane prospect to approach this subject through comedy. But at the same time, people were really laughing. And I think in terms of agenda, I feel like one of the uses of comedy can be to dissipate fear. And we've been living in an atmosphere of fear for such a long time in the country that it makes it almost impossible to have a rational thought. And beyond that, I then started to think of an overall theme. I didn't really care that the movie was lampooning American Idol or lampooning the current administration. What I was interested in was in making a movie about what I think is a core aspect of American identity, which is the idea that everybody has a dream, and that's always looked at as a positive thing, and in a way is the best thing about America. But at the same time, the question presents itself of whether that makes it impossible to deal with reality.
And whether those dreams are good or not.
Yeah, and oddly in the movie, the person whose dream saves him is this show tune loving terrorist who has a dream that he could become a star because he's gotten chosen for this American Idol type TV show. But I think on various levels, you can see how this idea of American identity being that in which we have to all be aspiring towards something greater than what we are affects us. And on the political level, I think that one can look at sort of the Bush administration's dream of creating democracies in the Middle East and sort of like this idea that if you just have a dream and adhere to it, everything's going to be okay. And I think that in terms of political discourse, that the idea of shades of gray has gotten such a nasty, it's almost like the third rail of politics. I mean, beyond all the sort of political mistakes that Kerry made in the last election, it seemed like the one thing that really ruined him was the idea that he was able to look at both sides of an issue, which seems to be the hallmark of intelligence. So I think now is the time to question whether dreaming is an appropriate reaction to the world.
Yeah, so one of the points you're making is that dreams are sometimes delusions, and it's helpful to know the difference. Now, you had me from the open of the movie. In the opening of the movie, we see like a terrorist training camp, and one of the terrorists in training is incredibly inept. And then we see him in the evening in his tent, and he takes out this like little old cheap outdated turntable and puts an anthology of Broadway songs on it. And then we see him singing and dancing along to the song One from A Chorus Line. And
yeah, I mean, I think that the initial comic thing I was thinking about was this sort of terrorist training video that we've all seen 500 times and wondering what it was like when they shot it. And what if there was a sort of inept guy who was ruining every take because he couldn't hang on to the monkey bars and he couldn't get over the wall. There's this guy, Omer, played by a newcomer, Sam Galzari. And the next time you see him, he's in a tent and you're not sure what he's doing in his tent. You're thinking maybe he's up to some nefarious plot. And then he takes out this scratchy old record, which is, it turns out, was his mother's record, and she loved show tunes. And the reason that this particular guy is at this terrorist camp, which he's incredibly ill-suited for, is that his mom was killed by a stray American bomb. The character itself, to me, feels like kind of early Woody Allen, or was kind of a schmuck who's at the mercy of forces larger than he is. And you know that in his heart of hearts, he's not suited for being an extremist.
I think this is the only film I can think of that has the potential of offending Simon Cowell, President Bush, and Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to reach my core audience of terrorists under the age of 25, but that's what I'm hoping is going to show up. It's true. I think that the best thing I could hope for the film is I saw an early screening and there was a guy in the focus group afterwards who said, God, there's all these things I stress out about on a daily basis. And for an hour and a half, I was able to laugh at them. And that actually felt like kind of a really good thing. So that would be my sort of best hope for this film.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had a test screening of this, and that if you did you have to screen it for people who knew American Idol and who could get all the American Idol jokes?
Well, I mean, the odd thing is that when I wrote it, I actually had not watched American Idol.
No,
I just knew
really?
It was out there. I knew it was out there in the culture in a huge way. And so the first draft, I just sort of guessed at what it was like. And frankly, I wasn't modeling Hugh Grant's character on Simon Cowell or Ryan Seacrest. I was really modeling it on Hugh Grant. The idea of a really smart guy who kind of loathes what he does and what he's become famous for, but is addicted to doing it nonetheless. And so then once I wrote it, I went and watched last season and became quite addicted myself to the show. And then I altered some things, but through the initial idea, I had no idea what American Idol was actually like.
You had to create songs for the performers in your American Idol show, American Dream. So I think you wrote the lyrics to them yourself?
Yeah. Well, the movie did not have a wildly large budget, given some of the crazy things that happened in the movie. So at first, I wrote into the script all these big pop songs, and then I realized I wasn't going to be able to pay for them. So I went to Stephen Trask, who had written the score for Inga Company and who also wrote the songs and music for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And he's a really terrific sort of pop song composer. And I said, why don't we sort of parody all these mainstream brands of music that they would sing on American Idol. And so he came up with this anthemic song, Dreams with a Z, that Mandy Moore sings. And then we wrote a faux country western song called Mama Don't Drink Me to Bed, both of which are sung by Mandy Moore, who, despite being a pop star, is an incredibly good singer as well.
Then there's also a great song. We only hear a few seconds of it. But Trey Parker actually plays like the rocker on the show. He sings this great song, Rockin' Man. Was it? I'm a genuine rockin' man.
Well, that was a little bit from watching the last season of American Idol.
With Bo Bice. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seemed like it was... they kept trumpeting that they finally had rockers on American Idol. So then there's a sort of moronic... guy who only sings songs about being a rocking man.
Dennis Quaid plays the president in American Dreams, and you portray the president as somebody who is not very bright, and who wears an earpiece in which he he is told by his chief of staff what to say and when to say it. But the president starts to rebel. The president starts reading the newspaper, and once he actually starts learning what's happening in the world, he starts to question things. Do you want to describe how you wrote The President the way you did and why?
Yeah. I mean, I took as a starting point his famous quote that he doesn't read the newspapers. And so I've always wanted to do something about a president who's having a nervous breakdown. And I thought, well, what if this guy had a little bit of a breakdown because he woke up on the morning of his reelection and felt kind of cocky and decided to read the newspaper for the first time in 4 years. And this caused him to realize that he'd been making decisions based on a black and white view of the world. And the more that he learns, the more sort of he doesn't want to leave his bed in the bedroom of the Oval of the White House. It's not, you know, because it's Dennis, it's he's able to create a relatively fully formed character, I think. And I'm not particularly interested. I mean, I happen to have my own feelings about Bush, and I don't think that he's going to wake up any day soon and sort of reassess everything that he's done. But that was not my aim with this movie. My aim was to have a character that begins in a place of being kind of blind and suffers because he is learning about things. And then in the end, his kind of triumph in the movie, Dennis's triumph, is not that he suddenly becomes smart, but it's actually that he decides that he wants to deal with reality and with the idea that things are not easily solvable. So in a way, it starts as a parody of the administration, but I'm interested in creating a character, which the movie model that Dennis and I were talking about most was Peter Sellers' character in Being There, the Chauncey Gardner character, sort of a Candide-like character.
The president's chief of staff is played by Willem Dafoe, but you have him costumed and made up to look like a very trim and more youthful Dick Cheney.
Yeah. When we were thinking of Willem, when I was thinking of Willem to do it, we made a computer morph of Willem's face with the top of Dick Cheney's head, and there was just something really funny about it, I thought, and we sent it to Willem along with the script, and I think he got a kick out of the idea of looking like that. Willem actually has become one of our best comedic actors. He always was a fantastic character actor. But now I think in movies like Life Aquatic and this one, he's really, really funny.
You had said earlier that you modeled the Simon Cowell character that Hugh Grant plays on Hugh Grant himself, because Hugh Grant has become somebody who really loathes what it is that he's famous for doing. What does he loathe about acting or about the movie business?
Well... Hugh is a really smart guy, and actually, I think personally, I'm interested in the intersection of cynicism and idealism, and all my films are in that terrain. And this film is particularly in that terrain because it's saying some really cynical things, but also I'm lucky enough to have a relatively optimistic view of human nature. And I think maybe that's why I like and care about Hugh so much, because he sort of sees the imbecilic aspects of his job and of fame, and he claims to despise acting, but at the same time, he'll show up on the set with his script filled with notes, and you know that the night before he shows up on the set, he's been worrying about whether he's going to do a good job or not. And so there's some element of him which is still deeply idealistic, and I think when you are really smart enough to see the baser things about human nature and about your own nature, that makes your idealism more exquisite and painful. And that, to me, sums up Hugh. He is a deeply cynical guy who has a kernel of idealism, which he would hate me or anyone talking about.
And the inept terrorist, when he performs on American Dreams, sings The Impossible Dream and My Way. How did you choose those songs for him?
When I was looking at show tunes for that character, I was looking for songs that had a very specific and strange change of meaning when they were sung by a terrorist. And so Impossible Dream has these lines, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause, and it seemed bizarrely apropos. I think that part of the task here was to make that character watchable. I mean, the very strange thing that happens in this movie is that the two most sympathetic characters are Dennis Quaid's president, who has a lot of Bush's qualities, but does not share the quality of seeming to never actually change his perspective on things, but actually becomes humanized during the course of the film. And this sort of show tune singing terrorist who is doing what he's doing for a reason, which is that he says early on, his mother was killed by a stray American bomb. I wanted the Omer character to be as sympathetic as possible, and to kind of separate him from the other terrorist characters in the movie, and have him be kind of a redeemable character. And so there's something very sort of like vulnerable about somebody going out there and singing show tunes in front of a big audience.
So when you look at Bin Laden tapes, you know, in which he's like threatening the United States and the Western world, do you just imagine him singing and dancing?
I'm not sure I'm quite capable enough of, I mean, I'm terrified along with everybody else. There is no question. But at the same time, these are people who take themselves deeply seriously. And when you are a relativist and a humanist, you want to poke holes in anyone who takes themselves terribly seriously. I look at it and I'm horrified. And at the same time, it's interesting to know whether he did it all in one take or whether, you know, whether the camera was in focus the first time, whether he was, you know, yelling at the sound man to stop cracking his knuckles while he's giving his speech.
Well, Paul Weitz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul Weitz wrote and directed the new film American Dreams.